So my name is Arnie Lund, and I am in IT, serving as UX community lead for Microsoft's IT organization. And then I have a team that's responsible for developing common tools to be used across IT systems. We also are supporting applications that will be the emerging self-service kind of experiences that customers have where they use to buy products, get support for the products, all that, as well as systems that are used by our partners, those who build for us, sell for us, you know, consult for us, as well as systems for our account teams that support those customers.
I'm Monty Hammontry. I'm the Director of User Experience for the Developer Products Division. I run a team of roughly 25 user researchers and designers. We do the usability testing, user research for all of the Visual Studio product family and the .NET runtime and the new Visual Studio Team System product line.
And I'm Dennis Wixon. I'm the User Research Manager for Microsoft Game Studios. We have about 22 usability researchers who do the usability work for all of Microsoft games, including console games, PC games, casual games, and games on the Internet. So we support for a total of about 60 products, and we support development studios throughout the world, all the way from Finland to Japan.
Great. So let's kind of open it up and talk a little bit about usability and kind of start at the beginning. And I think what would be great to have is just a definition. How do you see usability? How do you define usability? How are you using it? And start with Dennis.
Okay. So for the usability in games is fairly unique. So we look at usability in games as the successful communication of the design intent to the actual game player. So we see our role as taking the designs that the various studios come up with and putting them in front of users so that the designers can get the feedback as to whether or not their intent was realized. One of the reasons why usability in games is different than traditional usability or usability for productivity products is because the only reason to play a game is for entertainment rather than to accomplish some productive job.
A task.
You know? Yes, exactly. And so, therefore, a unique design problem in games is getting the challenge of the games right so that it's an entertaining experience as compared to with most productivity products, you'd want to minimize the, quote, challenge
right,
so
sure.
People can actually accomplish their tasks.
Right.
So for us, usability has a sort of unique kind of cast, which is helping the designers understand whether or not the intent of their game is what was actually communicated in the interface.
Great. So talking about productivity tools, we'll switch to that.
Sure. So things have evolved in our group over the last couple of years where many of the researchers on our team don't use the word usability anymore. They talk about design research, and they talk we do design research through the whole life cycle from ideation and germination of the what we're going to do in the product to conceptualizing and getting feedback from the marketplace around the product concepts that we're considering through to optimizing those concepts and getting validation in a number of different formats. Through the more traditional usability testing in the lab when we get into implementation, et cetera. So our team, more and more, they'll, you know, if you say usability engineer, they'll correct you and say, no, I'm a design researcher.
All right, design researcher.
And we still do usability. That's still a cornerstone activity for us. But usability in the traditional sense of lab testing, et cetera, represents one thing in a much broader envelope of activity that we do. we talk about, Steve Jobs has a quote that design is the soul of a man-made thing. And we spend a lot of our research efforts trying to get the soul right for the product, rather than just testing to see if the outer layers are correct. But both things are critical to us being successful in the market.
Right. Great. Right.
Yeah, and I think what I share in common with Monty and Dennis is that I don't think about usability in the way it is traditionally thought about, and like a lot of the people will be thinking about it who are probably engaged in what we're talking about through World Usability Day. Where I've always come at it from, and this is out of a product history, is what makes an experience a desirable experience that people adopt and use? What causes them to buy the experience? What causes them to use the experience? What causes them to be loyal to the experience or extend the experience into new things? And some research that I've done in the past is, and that others have done, suggests that's driven in part by a concept of satisfaction and expectation for satisfaction and delight that you're going to get out of this experience. And that, in turn, is driven by the notion that you're going to get value from that experience. And ease of use, which is often used as the synonym for usability, is about, in many ways, kind of removing the barriers to get the delight. But the meat of the burger, if you will, is the usefulness and that delight that you're trying to get at. Now, what that does for me is that opens up the kind of value that we can offer much more broadly than traditional usability. And you know, as Dennis says, beyond kind of thinking about productivity, thinking about time and error reduction and efficiency, what we're worrying about in my space right now is relationship. How do you build relationship between a customer and Microsoft's brand and all of Microsoft's products? And that notion of relationship taps into the full human being, and the full human being has lots of needs that you can address. And some of it is emotional, some of it is social, some of it is potentially spiritual and cognitive, many different things that you can tap into. And we, as design researchers, designers, need to understand how to address those. So when we talk about usability, actually we really talk more about user experience. And that's what we're interested in, and then driving that adoption.
So you've all kind of mentioned the traditional way of looking at usability or design research. What do you think has driven this evolution of the practice itself?
Well, I think in some ways it's a realization of the role that we play driving the business value that the corporation has. I mean, if you look way back, a lot of it was treated, usability was treated in some ways much like a quality assurance thing, like a test thing at the end. But the value we play is more like what Monty is saying, getting at the soul of the design. Really, what is that thing that is going to be that thing that brings value for that user, that makes a difference? And when you choose that, you choose that based on a business expectation that you have. You're going to sell a game, or you're going to enable a business to work more efficiently or connect with their customers in a better way. Those are all kind of business things, and I think the realization is if we do what we do right, then we're delivering on that. But to do it right engages us in a much broader definition of usability than just error correction.
Well, I think to a certain extent, too, it's the evolution of the field of computing and technology. So when a number of us got started in the field like 25 years ago, it was the case that we had emotionally engaging interfaces. They mostly engaged people, made people cry or made people angry. We've always produced emotional products, but just the wrong emotion.
That's right. Frustration.
And so in a sense, the field grew up attacking the most immediate problem as they saw it. So the first immediate problem was let's get all of those things that are causing tremendous frustration out of the product. Let's remove all of those barriers. And as those techniques and technology and methods and procedures and relationships and organizations built up, they naturally moved on to the next important problem, which is now that we've removed a bunch of the barriers, how do we understand better what the value is to the customer, what the experience of the customer is that we're looking at. We personally had the experience at DEC of routinely improving the usability, the measured usability of products by 20 or 30%, and at the same time having those products fail in the marketplace. And when we,
why is that?
Because we had removed all of the barriers to an experience or to a product that nobody in the end wanted. So it's like something that's, you could have this meal for free.
I don't want
this meal. It's like, so much of the evolution toward a more holistic view or a more complete view of usability was to sort of solve the problem we saw on the horizon as we solved other problems. And I think that's where each team has sort of taken things.
Yeah.
I think another notion, another thing that I guess we've all been around for a while, that I think has been observed is just the diversity of the number of people in our, the skills and the backgrounds of the people in our field. And when we started, it was most common kind of computer science folks and psychologists who were sort of the core of what we were about. And I think as the web has emerged and GUIs emerged and so on, that you can see much more visual designers getting in, people coming out of writing and storytelling, and many more diverse backgrounds all coming into this field, who also bring in that diversity, this richer understanding of what it is to be kind of human and what it is to create great design.
So you mentioned the variety of people that you have on your teams. How is usability addressed specifically in each of your teams? You're all hitting something a little bit different. You're talking about entertainment and productivity tools. Is there a common approach that you use? I would assume that you each have a kind of a different... There's common themes, because you're all trying to create value and an emotional connection, but is there something that differs in the way that you kind of look at usability and the way that your product is handled?
Yeah, one of the things that makes Microsoft such an exciting place to work is there's so many people around you to learn from, because while I think, if we were to list down our core tenets, our core belief systems, if the three of us did that, you'd find that there was an incredible match between what really drives the way we look at the world and what really drives the way we have our organizations attack the business imperatives. But
what are those beliefs for you?
To me, the neat thing that I was going to share was when I look at what Dennis is doing, that's just so incredibly exciting to me, because he has a context that's different from mine, but he's innovating within that context. So it turns out in his world, he knows what people are in, what their intent is, right? He knows they don't want to get killed.
Right.
He knows that they want to score as many points as he can.
Right.
He knows they want to get to the end of the of a given level. And his team has done some of the most innovative work I've seen in my career in terms of being to use like software instrumentation, data visualization. He can put 30 people into the level of a game and give you a visualization of how they run through that level. And you can see by the timing of of these 30 people in conjunction where people are getting stuck, where they're failing, where they're dying. And so just the amount of innovative stuff in the field that he's doing because he's optimizing for his context is just, it's mind-boggling how far ahead they are of anything I've seen, outside the Microsoft for that domain.
So would you say that the optimization then is kind of key?
Yeah, but it all comes out of these same core tenets. But Dennis is redesigning what usability means in terms of his business context he's in and the practices his team follows. But it's based on the same core belief system that I have. My team is getting actively involved in the product germination and conceptualization phase, which is a part that Dennis is, that's not a priority for Dennis, because most of that is happening inside the studios.
So you're preparing more at the front end of it than rather at the back end of the process.
So we're much more split between how do we help generate? How do we help conceptualize? How do we help bring the user to life inside the four walls of Microsoft to feed that early process and follow it all the way through to the end? So we're doing much more things like digital ethnography, where we're using technologies like live meeting to be able to open digital windows to users all around the world, being able to do longitudinal research, so we look at user behavior as it happens over time. So a lot of our emphasis is on engaging with the real world. There's a famous quote from a guy in our field, you can't know Niagara without spending the jungle.
Right.
We'll make time economical and impactful and viable. The product units, that's a key area that our team is innovating in. We're still doing usability tests that the protocols look very similar to some of the studies that Dennis is doing, but he's innovating in one domain, we're innovating in another domain. And when you look across Microsoft, innovation that's going on in the field of user research is just so far ahead of anything. It's just amazing. It's like not just one step forward. What Dennis is doing is like three steps forward. And so we can look around, and because we have these Petri dishes, we can go, oh, I can use that. I can't do data visualization in the same exact way that Dennis does, but I can look at it, apply the same general underpinnings and say, oh, I can take that and turn it and then plug it into the productivity space. So I think we're all, like you pointed out, sounds like you guys are all kind of different flavors of ice cream,
right,
and that's true.
Yeah.
Well, I would say yes, definitely true, but also not want to lose the common tenet.
I think
part of what you hear is among us all, there's a user-centeredness, a commitment to starting with understanding who the users are deeply and applying that understanding to every part of the process that in our various places we end up touching, and supporting a design process, an exploratory, creative, sketching early process that gradually reflects diversity down to what you're actually going to build. Mm-hmm. And that kind of applies, I think, in each of our places. But I agree totally with where Mon's at. I mean, I think we're you know, slightly different spin, but have a good example of that reaching across. You wouldn't normally think of what we do in the IT space as being related to games. But on the one hand, we've got early stuff going on. I've got an ethnographer out in the field working with, you know, some IT businesses, trying to understand all their touch points with Microsoft and our partners to kind of get at making that user real in our development environment. But then we've got in the middle part, you know, techniques that we're exploring that come out of Dennis's world of rapid iteration of testing small numbers of people and modifying designs and seeing how that works and then testing again so that we can speed things up in an agile process.
Kind of iterative.
Exactly.
Approach.
And then we've got a baselining at the tail end that for us is really important to understand how are these things working when they're in the field, identifying where there are gaps and pain points that we need to continue to refine. And then because most of the systems we support are out there for a long time and go through lots of iterations, we have a high commitment to continuous improvement to those things. And we also, because we have a small UX community supporting a very large part of Microsoft, are very concerned about how do we create scalable processes that amplify their impact into other groups that don't have UX. So each of us is driven by different forces, has to innovate in different places, but I think they're all kind of in common in terms of that commitment and how we
sound.
I think if you wanted to use three words to characterize the field and how it's evolved, mm-hmm. you'd say broader, deeper, and faster. So the research methods are all broader. They started in the lab, et cetera, but then they've spread out. And like Monty has done a tremendous amount of work in terms of getting that initial field in an economic way into the early conceptions of design, which is a need that we don't particularly have, so we haven't developed methods there. We've worked on another part of the business. So you get that broadening of the focus of user research. At the same time, you get a deepening of the user research. What we look at, we're looking at in a much deeper way. So we're studying behavior in more depth. Understanding all the different motivations that users have, the ways in which they respond to the system, the context in which they work, goes deeper than it did in the early days. Mm-hmm. And then all a common theme across all of usability, as long as it's evolved, has been faster, more economical. Get the data quicker, get mm-hmm. the data in a way that we can fit into a development process, whatever that development process is, because
right.
if the data is too late, it's useless.
Right.
So it's like we tried to reduce the cost to the business of user research overall, and that's been a common evolutionary theme, and it's common across all of us.
Yeah, we all have the philosophy that we have to immerse ourselves in the business. We have to go just totally native into the domain that we're working in. I knew Dennis had gone completely native when I saw him in a t-shirt. When I first got to know Dennis, I never thought I'd see him in a t-shirt that said "Frag Me" on the front. And I think while we do all have this same, like Arnie was saying, the same core lens, you know, the way we win the world by watching it, right? You know, that kind of learn by observing, learn by engaging with people. Mm-hmm. And then we all have this bit where we also really get in a richer way, I think, than many other disciplines to learn by trying, right? We're going to, you know, let me touch it, let me feel it, let me try it. And so the way that we look at the world is very common, but also when we look at the context we're in, we're all innovating, adapting, and different stuff.
And you all seem to have a little bit of a different method in the way that you obtain that information.
I think if he and I switched places, though, we would have done very similar things.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
I think that's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess the one question I have then is for people who are watching this video who, you know, are looking at this and learning more about usability, what's the advice you give to people outside of Microsoft on how to accomplish success through usability? Maybe some of the exercises or some tools that you use. You mentioned using Live Meeting. I'm interested in how you use Live Meeting to gather information.
So basically, one of the things that we found that we couldn't live with as a constraint, right? It just was too constraining for us to try to engage with our user population by having them have to come on campus and go into a lab. Mm-hmm. Many of the populations that we deal with are pretty specialized, pretty distributed, and we needed to be able to engage with them and learn from them in a very intimate way, right? So what we do is basically use Live Meeting to open digital windows onto whatever population we need to study, and then basically it's the equivalent to the one-way glass in the usability lab, mm-hmm. except they can be anywhere on the planet.
Right.
So we're using Live Meeting as that digital, we're doing shared desktop with them so that basically we're taking the one-way glass and scaling it out to being anybody that has a big enough pipe, we can basically treat them like they were in the same room.
So I've been involved in usability testing where there is that one-way glass, yeah. and sometimes it the people who are participating in that, sometimes because they're out of their element, sometimes you end up with not the results you're lacking. Does the Live Meeting and putting that back them in their own living room or their own comfortable space, does that help provide different types of results, perhaps? Difference probably not the right word. But
so a really good usability engineer, one of the distinguishing characteristics, by the time they get from the lobby in Building 25 mm-hmm. to the room, the participant feels like they've known them for their whole life. And it really does disarm that whole overall context. There maybe is a little bit of that, but generally I'm not as worried about the fact that people in the lab may feel like they're in a fishbowl. Usually we can work past that, get past that.
Okay.
What the Live Meeting thing allows us... So Dennis and I, a few years ago, did a kind of a taxonomy where we talked about all these different research methods. Sometimes you need to be naturalistic and study the user in their world. Mm-hmm. Other times, then the answer you need dictates that you need to run a controlled or a targeted study, right?
So in the world, just to clarify, is more ethnography.
That's right.
Type
so definitely Live Meeting is a key tool when you want to study the user in their environment, right? You don't want to bring them into Microsoft and say, tell me what your day is like, right? That's not a great a great way, right? You, in fact, one of Dennis's rules of thumb, right, is you always say, show me. Anytime the user tells you anything, say, so over live meeting, they really can't show you, right?
Yeah, sure.
So, but also through live meeting, when the situation dictates, you can run a targeted study through live meeting, right? You can say, you can set up the environment here, have them terminal serve into it or access it in different ways, and you can run the usability study where they're remote. But the big way that we use it most of the time is to do that where we can actually say, show me, and they can show us in their environment.
Well, I think another way to think about it, and if you know, you're talking about what advice would you give somebody on the outside, I think it's interesting. There's sort of the core set of principles that always remain true. Early on, I realized, gee, I could do my job with a watch and a pencil and paper and eyeballs. You know, I just could go out and do what I need to do. But there's a virtually unlimited set of tools out there and emerging tools all the time. I mean, you know, we have sort of Web 2.0 stuff that we will be figuring out how to use to do research in new and interesting ways.
And what are some of those core principles here?
Well, I mean, you want to be able to identify what is the thing that's causing a particular effect or problem, so you know how to fix it. You want to be able to develop models that explain the patterns that you're seeing. And so you're looking at the things that are shaping those patterns, and because it's a model, that will allow you to predict what's going to happen if you make a change. You're looking for validation. You want to make sure that your inference is a good inference and is a meaningful inference. You want to be able to generalize it to new situations and not have it be too context dependent. And that kind of gets to what Monty was saying, is you sort of want to know, you want to have clear questions that you're trying to answer, and part of what you choose from all these tools are the set of tools, the location where you apply those tools, and the method that you apply to those tools, based on the question that you're trying to answer, and yet to make sure you have a valid, generalizable...
Right. I would assume that kind of the tool is kind of... beside the point, as long as you understand what the question, what is it you're trying to solve.
And that's why, you know, I'm dealing with a new project team and assigning a designer, researcher team to that team, and they say, okay, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, let's talk about what are the dates that you're driven by. I've got a set of tools that I can apply. Now, if you give me more time, I'm going to give you more data and
That's
more
right.
understanding and more design. But if you've got 1 week, I can give you something in 1 week. I can put you in a better place through more understanding by picking the right things that I can do in a few hours than you would have otherwise been.
And what is the method that you use to provide
data? Yep. So the thing that we use a really broad kit bag of research techniques, right? So people talk about, marketing does research too, you know, and there's a lot of overlap. Everybody in our field knows how to do, for the most part, knows how to do surveys.
Right.
So we can do the broad market type research. But the thing that really is our bread and butter that distinguishes us, that really nobody else plays in our sandbox to the same depth we do, is to learn by observing. So we learn by watching, right? So whenever we're talking before about that early generative and conceptualization phase, people talk about exciters. Have you ever heard people talk about, you know, where we really want to go in the product? We want to figure out what the exciters are, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out exciters, one definition for an exciter is it's a latent need that the user had, but it feels natural to them once they receive it, right? So it's like an old friend that they never knew, right?
Right, sure.
So one definition of, product innovation, real product bang for the buck, is to deliver on one of these latent needs. Well, the way we go about doing research through observing, I would argue, is really the only legitimate, repeatable way to uncover latent needs. You can't go out and ask people, what do you want that you don't yet conceive,
they don't
right? Like, but you can innovate like nobody's business by going out and engaging with people in their environment mm-hmm. and watching their experiences, and all of these opportunities just start. If you know how to do the emergent analysis on your day, just start coming out of that observational learning. Same thing when we're doing more back end, when we're optimizing and implementing. The way we optimize and implement is by and tune the implementation is by observing, right? So if you were to try to boil it all down to one single statement of what's our special sauce, every time there's anything, we want to see it. We want to observe it. We want to have the user.
You sort of see time and time again, you know, in usability studies, even as just one illustration of that, where somebody's sitting there and they're crunched down and they're tight and their faces, and you can tell the tension that they're expressing as they're working with this thing. And then you say, well, how was that? And they say, oh, it's fine.
Yeah. You can clearly tell that it was.
Yeah.
I mean, the critical thing about any set of tools is to know the problem space, which we've already alluded to, but also to know the audience that you're dealing with, not just the audience for the product, but your internal audience, mm-hmm. what they need and how they think and what kind of problems will they uncover. So we have, for example, three sets of tools that we use, and they span sort of the range of things. We have very quantitative tests that we do called play test, where we bring people in, they play a game for an hour, and we survey them on hundreds of items that make that game successful or not. That's the way we benchmark our competitors. Mm-hmm. And that provides information toward the initial conception of a game, because often games are like movies. They say, I want something that's a little like Unreal Tournament, but also has a few elements of this other game. We say, okay, we know how those games tested in our lab. Here's the data. Here's their strong points. Here's their weak points. Here's how users responded to them. So there's that quantitative component. Mm-hmm. Then there's the qualitative iterative component. The major aspect of that is what we call write testing, where we have the designers and the usability engineers sit and watch the users and then redesign the product on the fly between sessions. So the product is actually improving as you're doing the test, and you're checking your improvements to see if they really are improvements. Because
right.
we made a number of things that, you know, there have been a lot of times when we made an improvement and found out it was worse than it was before. And so we could get a deeper understanding, either just back it out or make the next step on that improvement. And that's particularly useful because it cements something that's often overlooked by particularly new people, is the most critical thing is the relationship between the user researchers and the team that's doing the design, whether they're on the same team like Monty's or they're on different teams all over the world like we work with. And then the final sort of tool that we have is our deep gameplay instrumented testing, which Monty was talking about earlier, where we collect a lot of data, including video data, and organize and analyze it so it can be quickly, so designers can quickly look at the data and drill down and find out where the issues and problems are. And that method is designed for when the product is designed for late in the cycle, but part of the reason for that is that there is a tradition and history in gaming of what they call tuning the game. So they build the fundamental elements of the game, they get the game working, and then they have a tradition of spending weeks or months fine-tuning and balancing the game. So our tools fit into that culture of games testing,
right, sure.
Just like Monty's tools fit into that culture of how do we understand the user's work to begin with so that we can generate a product concept at the beginning.
There was a Business Week article that came out about a year and a half ago that talked about design thinking and how that was a movement within industry and within the marketplace. And it contrasted design thinking to engineering thinking and business thinking, right? So the
Bruce Nussbaum article?
Yeah. So the based on that kind of tongue-in-cheek, I characterized, well, okay, market research, it's varied. The research that marketing does touches on a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. But at some level, what it does is it marketizes our understanding, right? It looks at the broad market and figures out, you know, what's the size of the market, what's the size of the revenue opportunity. So it marketizes decision-making. engineering thinking, based on the way it's described in that article, what it does is it makes decisions based on the laws and principles of the materials you're working with, right? Like, how can I make a sneaker that weighs half as much and lasts twice as long? Or how can I change the laws and the materials I'm working with to innovate through that? At our core, what we do is humanize the decision-making process. Even when Dennis is looking at this quantitative modeling of a broad set of gamers, one of the reasons he puts it into this visualization framework where you can see them as individuals who are dying, who are getting stuck, who are struggling, right, is to humanize that feeling of what's going on inside the game so that people can relate to it and understand it and innovate based on that deep human intimacy. So in general,
it makes it more real.
So in general, while we do broad market research on occasion, we tend to focus more on that deep intimacy.
And I was going to just say that, and that's partly why one of the things that has probably increased over the years is more work, more ethnographic work, field work, in-depth field work, where you're studying a smaller number of people, but you're going very deep with them. And, where we deal with INSAT numbers, and we sort of get those high-level things and the quantitative data that comes into the corporation, but you would be surprised how many times it is by going out and spending a small business person for finding out what is it that they experience as they can get products from us, work from us, from our partners, how do they work, why, when do they come here. Those are the stories that kind of drive ahas and say, we could offer this new function, we could offer this new way of delivering value to this person that would never emerge from virtually any environment.
Well, and you also get to see what happens outside of that.
Exactly.
As well,
and why, and what some of the other contexts are, and why it's important.
So let's just wrap up by saying tomorrow is here on campus, we're having the World Usability Day, and each of you are presenting on that. And unfortunately, we don't have time to get into the details of your talks, because that would go on for another hour.
at least.
Let's talk just briefly about why a world user, why am I participating in this, and kind of what is you're going to achieve with it.
Well, I know you're going to be talking more in depth about World Usability Day with some others too. I would say that it's important to highlight these for people who aren't aware of them. I mean, it's still true that part of what we do is not well understood kind of broadly in the population. It's not even probably well understood broadly in Microsoft and the opportunities to get value. And a particular day like this or a particular event like this where there's a chance to focus attention on it and highlight that becomes really important. I think it's also true that, as we've been talking about here, a lot of innovation happens here. And I think we're excited about the opportunity to share that innovation more broadly and hopefully help the whole discipline raise its level and the things that it can do, even as we want to learn from others and make sure that we're advancing our practice.
I love Microsoft, but I love what I do on parallel with the affiliation I have with the company. And so both are important to me. And I love the opportunity to share innovations that are happening in my craft, the ones that are appropriate to share outside the company. That creates a feedback loop for me. Anytime you enter a dialogue with somebody else or another group of people, that's a two-way communication. You actually learn through the act of sharing,
sure.
Right? So sharing to me is an important. While I'm sharing what I have learned, I get a lot back from every time that we do something like World Usability Day. Not only learning from other people who are presenting, but also learning from the chance to see the things that we're doing get echoed back off of the people that. So the people that come in to participate.
And it's not just Microsoft.
Not just Microsoft. are an incredibly valuable asset to me. I'm going to learn a ton tomorrow, not only from what other people have to share, but having the opportunity to share my talk.
There's still a lot, even though we've made a lot of progress, there's still a lot of suffering in the world from poor user interfaces. People attempting to do something and being frustrated and either not being able to get done what they need to do or feeling like, why can't I understand this interface, etc. And at the same time, on the flip side, there are tremendous lost opportunities from the business side. There's sort of nothing worse than a product that has the promise of helping people, making their lives better, delighting them, but is that promise is obscured by a poor interface, a suboptimal
the frustration
interface.
Of it.
Yeah, etc. I mean, I've seen a lot of products where people said, "I wish the product had this feature," and it did. It was buried somewhere in the product, you know. And so, anything that we can do to sort of raise the awareness of the possibility of making better products from both a user's perspective and from a business perspective is a good thing. And
it's
also
the emotional and the value,
exactly,
you were saying earlier.
Exactly. And also, I would second Monty's comment that we'll learn a lot from each other, because often we don't get the chance to talk except at dance.
Yeah, no, that's right.
You're doing that?
That's
right.
Great.
Wow. Gee, I didn't know you were right. doing that.
Yeah, well, I'm glad I was able to bring you through together. Great.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you very much.
Right, thank you.
Thank you.